The first presentation this morning, ATSC 3.0 in the real world, Michael Guthrie. Michael is an encoding technology specialist with Harmonic. He has been with the company for 18 years, working with TV stations, networks, and other Harmonic customers before and after photos. Michael has been in the broadcast industry for over 30 years. His roles have included engineering, marketing, sales, and field support. He's located in the New York City area, and he's currently responsible for solutions in ATSC and network broadcasters and programmers. Please welcome Michael Guthrie.
Thank you. Good morning. So as I like to say, I'm old and I've done audio, so I'm an old audio guy as well, you know. So we're going to talk today. Let's see. There we go. Okay. So I'm going to start out today, and we're really going to talk about ATSC 3, but it's useful to start out with maybe looking at where we've come from over the last, well, for me, 18 years. I joined Divicom, not Harmonic, it was Divicom in those days, 18 years ago, really as one of the first specialists for ATSC. At that time, we were making the transition from analog to digital, and there's a number of things that we had to do in order to make that transition, and a number of things that we gained. I mean, first of all, we got compression, you know. So we had real time compression with video, MPEG 2, audio Dolby. We got multiplexing. So you know, as an industry, your typical TV station went from being a single channel affair, only one thing to worry about. You know, you've got one signal in the air, you make it as good as you can make it. And, you know, that was everybody's goal. We moved from that to, well, we can have multiple programs, and, you know, but there are trade-offs. So there was a whole new way of thinking that had to evolve around when you become a multi-channel programmer as opposed to a single channel programmer. We had to change the way we got to the transmitter. We went from analog to digital there as well. And of course, we changed the modulation. So we picked up 8VSB. So compression and multiplexing, I mean, I think back to those days, and one of the discussions at the time was, is 18 megabits actually enough to do a 1080i? You know, and in the first generation of encoders, a lot of people would argue, but it was not. Our first encoder, the MV400, which was, again, a Divicom product, was really a second generation product. The first generation products were usually six SD encoders kind of strapped together. The MV400 was really one of the first encoders that sort of dealt with an entire picture at the same time. And it worked. You know, we got good pictures even on 1080i. Most of the early stations we put on the air with an MV400, we also had an SD. So that was really the second generation that people typically did two channels or could do two channels. So at the same time, we also picked up something called statistical multiplexing. So as soon as you do more than one channel, you've got to deal with the fact that you've got to decide how much to assign to each of the channels. And in constant bitrate, that was always difficult. And it wasn't just difficult because you had to make hard choices. It was also difficult because it was always a moving situation. What worked with one pair of programs an hour later didn't work anymore. So statistical multiplexing introduced the idea that the encoder can decide dynamically how to allocate the bits. And with only one or two channels, quite frankly, the gain wasn't huge, but the big advantage was you didn't have to constantly make those decisions. The encoder could do it for you. And even in those days, it was on a frame-by-frame basis. Basically, MPEG encoding in any flavor, whether it's MPEG 2 or MPEG 4 or HEVC, the required bit rates to encode a particular frame of video varies over a tremendously wide range. I mean, if you really let the encoder do what it wants to do, it will vary over a 20 to 1 or 50 to 1 range even from frame to frame. So the idea with statistical multiplexing is, you know, most of the time you're lucky and all the pictures don't need a lot of bits simultaneously. It's a very tricky thing to design. It's actually not, it tends to be, a lot of people think, oh, well, it's statistical multiplexing. You just vary them and keep the sum the same. It's not trivial. For one thing, you have to know in advance how many bits are going to be required. Otherwise, you don't have them available in time to give them to the picture. So one of the reasons why I joined Divicom in the first place was they had a white paper on what was probably the first look-ahead StatMux. This was back in 1998. It was the MV40, which was an SD encoder. And it would do a whole encode of the picture and then wait 3 seconds and then do the final encode. So it already knew when it did the final encode how many bits were going to be needed. And prior to that, a lot of times statistical multiplexing actually didn't work as well as CBR. So, but when I read the paper, it made so much sense to me. I knew nothing about encoding, by the way. I'd mostly been an audio guy up to that point. But it made a lot of sense, and I had the right group of contacts for the company, and we got along really well. So that's how we got to where we were. But basically the end goal of statistical multiplexing is constant quality. And in fact, it does achieve that if you've got enough channels. And by enough channels, really, you'd like to have 6 channels at a minimum, which, of course, in ATSC, we almost never have 6 channels. So it's the statistical multiplexing is particularly difficult in our business. But the whole idea is if you've got enough channels, the quality of each channel can remain relatively constant. Because there's always enough channels to average the statistics across, so you end up with constant quality across each one. If you run constant bit rate on every channel, what you have is variable quality. As the demands of the picture go up, the quality goes down, or as the demands go down, the quality of the picture goes up. So in the ideal world, if you've got enough channels, statistical multiplexing can just give you constant quality across all the channels. And the quality will vary with how many channels you try and stuff into the space. ATSC is really somewhere in between because we don't have enough channels to really get to the constant quality. So the big attractions when we did the first round with ATSC 1 was high definition and surround sound audio. I mean, those were the reasons why the consumers wanted it. Those were the reasons why the consumer electronics industry wanted it. I mean, as I recall at the time, you know, TV sets had gotten down to like $100 and they weren't making any money, and they really needed a way to sell more expensive TV sets. But high definition, of course, was the big attraction. Statistical multiplexing, you know, allowed more channels. So, you know, I went from, I don't know, maybe a dozen channels in the New York area to now I get about 60. So a tremendous increase in the amount of programming available over the year to the consumer. And that's an attraction. That's an attraction to the consumer. And ultimately, I think people are starting to make money, finally, on their .2s. You know, not all, but some of the .2s are doing pretty well now. MPEG 2 got better over time. And actually, it still continues to get better. I mean, we still get gains out of MPEG 2. So that's increased the ability to carry multiple channels to the point that now we can carry multiple HD channels. Coding and filtering, it's interesting what happened with MPEG 2, which is that, you know, a decade or so ago when our engineers were working on the first MPEG 4 codecs, engineering basically told us they're done with MPEG 2. There's probably nothing more that they can do. It's probably as good as it's ever going to get, you know. And so, you know, they put all their work for a couple of years into MPEG 4, and we got the first MPEG 4 working. And then, of course, MPEG 4 started progressing and fairly rapidly got to its goal of being half the bit rate of MPEG 2. But lo and behold, you know, a couple of years later, the engineers, all of a sudden, they start turning out code, and it's, you know, it's got improvements in it. And it turns out when you talk to him, it was like, well, you know, we did this in MPEG 4, and then we figured out we could actually do something very much like that in MPEG 2. So the MPEG 4 essentially ended up driving changes in MPEG 2 as well. And they in MPEG 4, they, you know, to get the bit rates even lower, they developed new kinds of filtering, and that plugged right into MPEG 2. So basically, we've gotten 30% better since they told us that, you know, that it was a corpse that was never going to arise again. You know, I mean, it's been pretty good. You know, there's been good improvements in it, and there continue to be more improvements. Although, you know, they're harder to get now. You know, and finally, you know, some of the techniques that were developed for MPEG 4 for statistical multiplexing also moved over to MPEG 2. So our first, you know, sort of encoder that could go both MPEG 2 and MPEG 4 had the horsepower to not just do one look ahead, but it could do two look aheads. And again, you know, I won't go into all the details, but again, there was a big improvement when we did that. And mostly it had to do with the fact that the early look ahead had no idea what the picture was going to look like, so it didn't do a very good job encoding it. So when they added the second stage, the second encoder then already knew what the picture was going to be like, so it did a better job of encoding it, which got it closer to what the final was going to be. So there was more fine-tuning that could be done after the fact. That was basically the idea. And that came from, first of all, the fact that the chipsets were 10 times as powerful, because that's what they needed for MPEG 4. So when you did MPEG 2, there was a lot of extra horsepower that could be used. But also, that was a technique that was developed for MPEG 4, which was more complex. Which brings us to where we're headed now. I mean, you know, so we have this new transition coming to ATSC 3, or we all think that there's a transition coming to ATSC 3. So, you know, we can take a look, you know, at sort of maybe the same sort of parallels, right? So we're going to change codecs again, and, you know, basically we're going to jump an entire generation. The MPEG 4, you know, is now sort of old hat. Which makes MPEG 2 really old hat. But so we're going to have HEVC, which is targeted to be twice the efficiency of MPEG 4, which would make it about four times the efficiency of MPEG 2. We're going to gain a new codec in audio, AC4. Again, there's a whole lot of things that come out of it, but an efficiency is only one of them. We're gonna change the way things are packaged. So the packaging for ATSC 3 has a lot in common with over-the-top streaming, much more so than it has in common with, you know, MPEG 2 transport. And then finally, we're going to end up changing the STL again. So you're going to end up with, you know, a new digital modulation. Basically, the STL needs to be an IP STL. So if you, I'm not going to go into the details. So, you know, I'm not the guy to ask the deep technical questions. I'll tell you that right now. I mean, you know, we've got Joel Wilhite. We've got some other experts on the staff. Many of these slides, by the way, are courtesy of Joel. But basically, if the main thing you look at when you look at this protocol stack is, the first is that, you know, You're essentially receiving something that looks like an over-the-top stream, a dash-packaged over-the-top stream. And if you look, there's really two vertical stacks. One is for broadcast, and the other is for broadband. So it's really a standard that bridges between something that's an over-the-air multicast and something that you can receive on a wired connection. And that hybrid nature is really the essence of, you know, what we're going for with this. You know, basically, my kids don't watch TV anymore. You know, they do. They watch it on an iPad, or they watch it on their computer, or they watch it on their phone. But, you know, both of them, when they went to college, I offered them a TV set. Don't you want a TV set for you? Nah, I've got my computer. I don't need a TV set. So, you know, the need to bridge these two things, I think, ultimately is, you know, tied with the need to keep our business relevant. And, you know, so, you know, you can talk about the bits and the bytes and this and the this and the that, but fundamentally, you know, there needs to be a way to tie together this, you know, this over-the-air broadcast phenomena with the over-the-wire phenomena that you know, the younger people are using. And quite frankly, there's business opportunities in that. You know, if you look at that, and we're going to talk about that a little bit. There's more presentations later today about ATSC3 and the organization and all that. You can get a lot of this information on ATSC.org. So I'm not going to dive into what all these are, but essentially, this is where the effort is concentrated to, you know, come up with a final standard that can be implemented. Looking at what this is going to look like, there's, you know, it's a lot more complicated than what we had before. You know, first of all, you can use either multiple carriers or single carriers. And even within a single carrier, you can have multiple layers or multiple physical layer pipes. And these physical layer pipes can be individually tuned essentially for different target audiences. So, you know, there's a multitude of ways that you modulate this, and each physical layer pipe essentially has its own modulation. So at one extreme, you get lots and lots of bits, but you need an outdoor antenna, you know, and probably a strong signal. At the other extreme, you get no bits, almost no bits at all, but it's incredibly robust, you know, and then there's a gazillion steps in between to choose from. You can also extend that across multiple transmitters as well. There you can look at the same sort of idea, which is that, you know, you might have a VHF transmitter and a UHF transmitter that are essentially sharing physical layer pipes. And part of the idea is that a lot of the new audience is gonna wanna be using this. And as you walk around, you need a very robust signal, otherwise it's not gonna work. So at one end of it, you change the modulation so that it's more robust getting to the phone. But the other one is that VHF and UHF, as you know, are very different about, you know, how they penetrate walls. And for portable devices, you know, the physical size of the antenna starts to really matter. I mean, you're probably not going to put a very good VHF antenna in a phone, but you can put a UHF antenna in a phone that will be effective. So kind of the idea here is that, you know, particularly since the digital transition to ATSC1, we've really been a fixed service. Essentially, if your TV's sitting still, and particularly if you can put a coax on it from an antenna on the roof, that'll work. Almost anything else is pretty iffy. And that limits the audience. You know, so part of the idea is, I mean, if you look at radio is mostly a mobile audience now. I mean, you know, it's no secret that most of the advertising in radio is during drive time. Television, I think, is going to be different. I don't think, hopefully, people won't be watching it when they're driving their cars. But maybe people will be in the back seat, you know, and I don't know how far away we are, but when the self-driving car happens and there's no steering wheel and no brake pedal and no gas pedal, maybe they will be watching it in cars. So the idea of this multitude of ways to carry things is really all about addressing a multitude of what are really effectively different audiences, different devices, different situations, different age groups. And through that, hopefully, we can generate a larger business. So if you look at the physical layer, you know, basically you can go from something that's like less than a megabit in a whole channel to something that's like, you know, over 50 megabits. And again, when you get down into the lower end, it's a little like satellite radio. You know, if you know anything about satellite radio, you basically, they take an entire satellite. they strap together all the transponders and turn it into like one huge transponder with a huge amount of ERP. You know, they put a huge amount of forward error correction on it, and as a result, you can really receive satellite with a hockey puck on the top of your car. You know, you don't even need the hockey puck on top of the car anymore. I mean, you know, so at one end you get, you know, extreme robustness. At the other end you get, you know, huge amount of bit rate. Again, I'm not an RF guy, but the consensus is that somewhere around 25 or 28 megabits you're going to replicate what you have now. In terms of coverage and robustness and the like. The receivers are required to support multiple PLPs, so it means that anything any receiver that meets the standard is going to be able to receive, you know, multiple different ones out of the stream. So I don't think it's going to be as simple as choosing one modulation. I think it's going to be more complicated because ideally you're going to figure out what the audiences, and I say, and it's plural, audiences are, and how much of the spectrum that's allocated to you is targeted towards each segment of the audience. So at one end, you know, you're going to want to put a very high quality signal out to these new TV sets that everybody's buying, and that'll be very similar to what you're doing today. But at the other end, you know, you're going to have an audience that, you know, maybe isn't in the car, but maybe walking around the house with a pad, or you know, maybe they're waiting online at the DMV watching a game on their phone. You know, that's a whole nother audience that you've not been able to address before. And so by having these multiple PLPs, you're going to address different specific audiences. Here's an example. I thank the Comark guys. I ripped this off out of one of their white papers. But basically, this is their take on maybe how you might use four different PLPs. You know, and if you look at the very, very robust end, you know, that may not even be carrying a picture. That probably is going to be carrying the signaling that allows your receiver to find your signal both over the air and over the internet. So one of the concepts that you have here is that you can accurately geolocate somebody as being within your transmitter coverage. So the idea there is when you go to buy programming, you know, the seller of the programming, one of the reasons why they sell to TV stations is that you're limited to a geography. As soon as you start getting outside that geography, they're going to want a very different contract. So, you know, at one end, you're competing with other TV stations. At the other end, you're competing with Showtime or HBO for a national audience. So part of the idea here is that you can transmit essentially a key that says, I can watch this channel, you know, over an internet delivery, over an IP delivery, but only if I'm also receiving the signaling over the air. So what that does is it allows material to be transmitted over the internet in a way that guarantees that somebody is within your transmitter pattern. And it's a game changer in terms of the way programming can be sold and the way programming can be consumed because, you know, all of a sudden, you're not limited to them just receiving the programming over the air. You can put it over the internet. But when you put it over the internet, you can have, you know, portions of the internet that are guaranteed to only be received within the transmitter pattern. So that's a big change. You know, so this hybrid delivery, you know, you can deliver the main program and, you know, maybe you can deliver some interstitials. I mean, maybe, for example, you know, maybe, for example, you target people in, you know, a particular demographic, you know. So one of the things that's likely to happen or one of the things that could happen is I've got this sub-channel, and if you want to watch it, it's still free to watch. You just got to register. So you go on the website and you know, you give them an email address, the typical registration, and that allows you to be, you know, some statistics gathered about you. Well, no, Google does. I mean, you know, it's like, You know, I go on Amazon and I look at a mattress, and for the next like 3 months, what I get on Google are mattress ads, right? I mean, we all know this happens. But by registering, for example, you know, you might be able to go to a car dealer and say, well, you know, we've got 4,000 registered users within a 5-mile radius of your dealership. You know, or we've got 20,000 within a 5-mile radius of your multiple dealerships. It can change the way you sell ads. And also, because you can have triggers, you can be showing that car, you can be showing a car ad for that dealer and have somebody decide, well, that's interesting, and click on it, and switch and get a much more an offer that's much more specific to them. You know, and you know, so Google makes money on click-throughs, basically. And you know, it's not just that they might get a penny for you clicking through. There are certain click-throughs that they might get $10 for. You know, I mean, the value of a click-through depends on the product and the placement and the person and all of that. I mean, you know, so again, it's going to be a much more complex model, but also a much richer model, potentially, for making money. And, you know, it offers the possibility of some non-real-time delivery, meaning you can push a program down to a TV set in anticipation that they might want to watch it. You know, the TV set can have it, or you can push a program down that is one that you don't broadcast, but which they ask for, and they then receive. And, you know, so you say, well, but they could watch it over the internet or whatever, but if it's a phone that they're watching on, they might be able to get it over the air and have it not hammer their data plan. So, you know, we'll have to see how all this works out. But basically, there's a lot of new business models here. And the important takeaway is that this is not just about bits and bytes. This is really about the future of the industry and how the industry is gonna make the future happen, how we're going to make money in the future. You know, and again, in terms of new ecosystems, you know, you've got the interactivity that I've been talking about. You've got security. You know, there's the potential to deliver scrambled services, although that's always been there in ATSC 1 as well, and it hasn't been widely used. But I think the layer of security that you can have in this announcement mechanism is a different kind of security. And, you know, it can power things like viewer registration, or it can power things like, you know, having an idea where the viewer is. There's a whole rich area of assets there that are going to change the way we do business. So, you know, looking, you know, I'm getting ahead of my slides here, you know. So having looked at all that, the question comes up is, how are we going to do this? How are we going to change from 1 to 3? You know, and so the first thing is that there is a movement afoot to essentially get the FCC to let us broadcast it, meaning don't mandate it, just allow stations to put it on a transmitter if they choose to. You know, and that's something that's sort of in progress. It's driven by, you know, it's driven by the NAB and some of the large groups and some of the consumer guys. And the idea is just, you know, if we want to dedicate spectrum to it, let us do it. But again, the looming question is, how do we make this transition? And so, you know, just these are my personal observations. You know, it's. I don't think that it's in the cards that the FCC is going to give everybody a second channel like they did the last time around. I mean, they're trying to claw back spectrum as it is. It's not likely that they're going to go out and give everybody another one. It's also not in the cards that, you know, my mother's going to go buy a new TV for this. You know, you can't broadcast both on the same channel at the same time, you know. It took us over 10 years. I mean, in fact, the analog transition isn't done yet. I mean, you know, if I scan my set, I actually still get a couple of analog channels where I live. You know, they're low power and all that. But, you know, analog is actually still, you know, a little bit alive there. I don't think the transition from ATSC 1 to ATSC 3 is going to be an overnight phenomenon. This is going to be a decade-long process once it gets started. And my conclusion is that about the only way this is going to happen is to share channels. And so let's just take a look at what that might look like. So first of all, looking at the concept, I mean, the FCC really kind of kicked off the idea themselves. So it's not like they, you know, it's not like they're going to be able to push back totally on this, you know. So there's a legal mechanism already been created because of the spectrum auction to actually be able to share a channel, you know, and not lose your rights as a station and all that. MPEG-2 today is just about twice the efficiency that it was when I started. So, you know, what we did, you know, 18 years ago, we can just about do two of now with about the same quality. And ATSC 3, you know, kicks off with much, much higher density than ATSC 1 has. So, you know, I think it is possible, and I'm gonna take a look at what this might look like. So I think as a practical matter, this needs to be a pretty advanced concept of channel sharing. So, you know, this is not the idea of, well, I pair up with another station and they put up an ATSC 3 and I put up an ATSC 1 and we share both. You might be able to do that. But I think as a practical matter, if everybody wants to keep everything on the air that they have now and be able to grow through the transition, because don't forget, this is not a one-year thing, right? I think that there's a need for, you know, a wider form of channel sharing. And one of the as a StatMux guy, as an encoding guy, one of the things that I know is that when you've got multiple carriers, assigning pictures across, there's huge gain in being able to put particular channels on particular carriers. I spent a little bit of time working in satellite where we had, the company I was working with had 13 transponders and somewhere around 300 channels on the air. And we had real video quality issues trying to get everything to work. This was a very early, you know, HD satellite service. And, you know, so a lot of what you had to do was you'd look at a popular channel that people were complaining about and figure out how to swap it into another transponder that had less load is what it boiled down to, right? So if we want to do that across a DMA, it's going to need to have multiple stations agreeing to, you know, to help with that. And I'm going to, let's look at some examples here. In terms of density. So ATSC 3 is much denser than ATSC 1. It uses HEVC, which is inherently four times the efficiency of MPEG 2. Right now, it's closer to three times, sometimes it's four times, depends on the program, but we're pretty certain it's going to converge like MPEG 4 did at about twice the efficiency of MPEG 4. Just as MPEG 4 started out only being 20 or 30% more efficient than MPEG 2 and fairly rapidly got to double the efficiency. Also, the modulation is going to allow higher bit rates. So you go from 19 megabits to 20, maybe 25 to 28 megabits. You know, you're going to give up some if you want some mobile carriage, but, you know, all in all, there's going to be more bits to play with. And, of course, some of those bits are going to be spent differently. So just some guesstimates on this. The first thing is we're not going to get all that gain because I think this is the stage probably that Interlace should go away. You know, all those 1080i's really need to become 1080p's, and unfortunately, that's gonna effectively double almost double how many bits we use. But then again, we're starting out with four times the efficiency, so you sort of end up with a 1080p at about half the bit rate of a 1080i because you're multiplying by two because you've got twice as many pixels that you're transmitting, but then you divide by four because you move to HEVC. I think the second channels, you know, and the mobiles and all that, 480p, for the same reason, you know, Interlace is not a good format for a phone. It's really not a good format for anything anymore because there's no interlaced devices left. I mean, the first thing that happens is it gets re-interlaced, right? So I think what it looks like is you end up with quite a bit of 1080p, quite a bit of 480p, and 720p actually happens to be a really good format as well. I mean, most of what you watch over the internet in HD is 720p. So if you look at what's required, you know, a 1080p is about 50 or 60% of the bitrate you're going to need that you currently need for a 1080i. And a 480p 8-bit, of course, and by the way, the 1080p HDR is like 50% if it's 8-bit, and it's more like, you know, you need maybe 60% if it's high dynamic range, because you're gonna throw some bits at that. The 480p, if it's 8-bit, it's about half of what you're currently using for the same quality. So if you take a look at what this looks like, how you'd split it up. So the first thing we got to do is we got to double up all the stations, ATSC1, if you're going to keep continuity. And these examples that I'm giving here are all real-world example, meaning I know stations that are currently using these combinations, right? I won't argue whether they look good, look bad, or whatever it is. They look good enough that people are willing to use it. That's all I can say. You know, but if you have a couple of transmitters doing SD only, you can fit about 10 to, you can fit somewhere between 8 and 12, depending on the quality, you know, in MPEG 2. One of the funny things here is that the combinations that you get if two stations pair up are the worst possible combinations. Two HDs and two SDs totally works. I've demonstrated it a million times. It's actually the worst possible combination. And the reason for that is, as I said earlier on, when you stat mux, what you really want is at least a half a dozen channels. And the more channels you have, the better it works. So SD, when you put all these SDs together, you get really good statistics, and you get a lot of statistical multiplex gain. So putting together all the SDs together, you actually get many more of them than you would if they were sharing with HDs. HD, on the other hand, is very efficient for an equal number of pixels. And that's because in HD, you've got this big picture that you can do motion search across, right? And there's a lot of correlation against different parts of the picture and against frame to frame. So the within a given picture, HD is much more efficient. However, as soon as you have HD in, you have many fewer channels. So ideally, you end up with all the SDs probably on one or two transmitters, probably two. You've got a couple of transmitters that are pretty much 720p with some SDs. You can get really pretty good quality there because the 720p is lower bitrate than the 1080i's are. You've got a transmitter or two with three 720p's. Again, that is actually on the air with quite a number of stations now, and it works pretty well, particularly if you don't have sports on all three, and especially if you only have sports on maybe one of them. And then you got some transmitters that are really just a couple of 1080i's. And again, that's a combination that actually works quite well in the field. On the ATSC 3 side, you know, you can have a transmitter that has, you know, a couple of dozen SDs, okay? And that's your mobile and your secondary channels and all that sort of stuff, you know? You've got a couple of transmitters that are doing, you know, the yeoman's work on the network stuff. So you've got, say, four 1080p's and, you know, eight or 10 720p's spread across a couple of transmitters. And then you've still got one RF left in this example to just develop new business. And, you know, maybe that's early on more ATSC 1 transitioning to ATSC 3. And then basically over time, you do what the cable guys do, which is that, you know, you take some of the ATSC 1 channels and you start getting rid of them. And you free up a channel as people buy more ATSC 3 sets. So this is a possible mechanism. You know, and again, it's probably possible with pairs of stations, but I think it's a much greater compromise. So, you know, just sort of looking at it, you know, in summary, you know, some final thoughts, you know, I see a consensus developing around 1080p. And when I say that, you know, why I say that is I've seen in a number of programmers, okay, you know, these are networks, both cable and broadcast networks, you know, this demonstration, which we've done at NAB, where you take UHD content, you show it full UHD on one TV set, you then take a version of that, convert it to 1080p, put it on an identical set, which upscales it back to you know, full UHD, and you look at those two side by side, and pretty much every time I've ever seen it, you can't see the difference. And in fact, you got to get up literally on top of the screen to see the difference, if there's any difference at all. So the first thing is that it's very expensive to broadcast 1080p in terms of the bits and the infrastructure that's required. It's also that there's a lot of TV facilities that are already for 1080p. I mean, if you bought a router in the last few years, it's already a 3-gig router. So there's a lot of gear that's already ready for 1080p. A lot of that gear is also more or less ready for HDR. And the HDR part of it is what you want to see in 4K is what you get with HDR. I mean, if you take a 1080p with HDR and put it side by side with, you know, similar content in UHD 8-bit, there's no question which one you're going to like. The HDR run, you know, is like you can be from here to the door looking at the sets and you can see that difference. So what the consumers want, what the consumer electronics people want, what we want in terms of picture quality, it's HDR that delivers that. It's not more pixels. So, you know, but when you look at the cost of delivering it, one is four times the bits and the other was another 20% or so. So just sort of looking at what I see across the industry, I think it's going to pretty rapidly converge on most day-by-day programming going to 1080p and sort of a lot of the advanced work going into HDR. It doesn't mean nothing's going to be shot in UHD. UHD is a great acquisition format for 1080p, and you retain a lot of value for the future. On an 8K set, I'm guessing that the UHD stuff is going to probably look better than the 1080p, but we'll see what happens. You know, the consumer guys are pushing 4K right now, but basically they don't have any choice. That's what they had. You know, what they wanted was everybody to buy 3D, and 3D failed miserably. They have to build the pipeline for TVs 3 or 4 years ahead. And they were so convinced that you know, 3D was going to be the thing that they all geared up to build displays that were full-res 3D. Well, guess what a full-res 3D TV screen is if you don't turn on the 3D? It's UHD. So essentially, they had all these factories set up. In fact, they converted factories that were doing HD to building these four times the resolution screens, these UHD screens, and they basically had no reason to use them, but they had to because that's the factories they have. So, you know, I think it's HDR that delivers what everybody wants, and so that transition will happen. It'll take longer. I think the trend is going to be away from integrating the ATSC 3 tuner, particularly early on. For one thing, it's inherently an IP stream. There's no, you know, and with, you know, 802.11ac. You get huge bit rates to the set without wires. So, you know, rather than forcing everybody to pull a coax to the set, I think the trend is going to be to have some sort of a module that then broadcasts wirelessly to the sets in the house kind of thing. And it's also easier to integrate. Most of the TVs now already have the Wi-Fi built in. They already have the ability to put an app in it. So you take an existing TV, put the correct app in it, add a tuner to it, and you can receive ATSC 3. You don't necessarily even need a new TV if you've got a TV that they can download apps to. The cable companies are actually doing the same transition at the same time in a different way. Cable companies are, in the next generation, very rapidly moving toward IP delivery, DOCSIS 3.0. It's an area that Harmonic's very involved with. They have the same issue that they've got millions of MPEG-2 boxes out there that can't go away overnight. So they're going to undergo a similar transition. And essentially, just as they can now very easily take an over-the-air ATSC 1 and put it onto a cable plant in QAM, they can also take an IP very easily and put it into a DOCSIS delivery. So their transition can be parallel to ours pretty easily, and their transition is in about the same spot as ours is right now. They're going to transition to, an HEVC IP-delivered infrastructure. Finally, you look at it, and basically MPEG-2 is the new analog. It's just as analog is still trying to go away, and it's almost gone now. MPEG-2 is going to go through this long-term, how do we transition away from it? Portable and mobile is going to be important. The internet link is critical. My take on it is, as a consumer, I don't really care how the signal gets into the set. My wife doesn't even know how it gets into the set. My kids kind of know. We got to stop thinking about how they get the channel and make sure they do get the channel, and that we make money on them getting the channel. Or if you're a public broadcaster, just that you're, fulfilling your mission, right? And just, I'm not even going to talk about this other than this is what we do. We're one of the last companies that only does this. And we've got a lot of people who are dedicated towards making better encoders and better delivery. So thank you. Thanks for having me. I know I'm a couple of minutes over. Questions?
You mentioned earlier that probably the best thing to do with the transition is do channel sharing. What would you recommend for a station that doesn't have that option? Because right now we are, I'm up north in Rhinelander, there's not a station closer than Wausau that we have the ability to channel share with. Is there any recommendations to an ease of transition into 3?
I don't know. I mean, you could look at, I think you're going to have to look at your audience and how they're getting your channel. And you're going to have to look at the cable systems and how they carry you. It's not easy because, what do you do when, I remember in the ATSC 1 transition, there was a point in time where all the thought, the thought was all about flat screen, large TVs. But 60% of the audience was watching on, 19-inch glass. And there's that really awkward point where your audience is kind of split, and the mind share is towards the new, latest and greatest, but the audience may not be. So it's not going to be easy. Maybe if there's open channels in your area, maybe you can get a low power temporarily. I don't know. The primary thing is cable coverage, I'm guessing, though. I don't know what percentage of your audience is cable.
I know that we're about 20% over the air up there, and the majority of it is going to be either DirecTV or Dish Network.
Yeah, so your contracts with them are probably going to be the most important thing.
Okay.
One more question. Regarding the channel sharing transition implementation, talk a little bit about how PSIP will be handled.
So PSIP actually works quite well in channel sharing. You don't have to give up your major channel number. You can have one transmitter with three or four different major channel numbers, if you like. It actually, you know, it's actually very flexible and works quite well. I know because I've built quite a number of ATSC-based cable systems. I build them for the broadcast headquarters, you know, where they want to have 3,000 TVs and rather, you know, so it's quantum modulation, but it's strictly PSIP based, and you can do almost anything you want with the channel numbers. So basically, the viewer, other than the fact that they're going to have to rescan their set to pick you up, and there's workarounds for that as well, by the way, probably isn't going to know the difference. Thank you.